was served as hors d'oeuvre, and we ran out. It was our first hors d'oeuvre that was so popular that it was consumed. People came begging for some more, and we ran out. We just couldn't, you know, give them any more. Aside from that, Washington, D.C., such as it was, you know, it's number one alcohol-consuming community in the United States. It was at that time. Second community I won't mention. But the Washington, D.C., a lot of alcohol was consumed. And, my gosh, I think we spent more money serving cocktails that evening down than we spent on the food itself. And more people came for the cocktail than they did for the meal, although we did have well over 400 people there. So that was quite a feat and a feat. And I think it did, and we did a lot of things like that to promote our ideas and to exchange thoughts with people in high places to make the ANCSA legislation a success that it was. Other comments that I have here. I think someone mentions, and it's true, we are established under the laws of the state as corporations. And for a lot of things, we must look to the state for assistance. I think we forget oftentimes that there are state agencies that are available to us to approach for assistance in helping the villages. Recently, in a case of my village, St. George, we were a traditional village council for a long time until we found that we were only getting $100,000 a year or so for making improvements on this and that in the village. And we discovered also that if we became a second-class city, we were eligible for other things and for grants and other money. So the village last year became a second-class city and is now existing as such under the as an instrument of the state. They can go to any state agency, including the governor on down, and the legislature and demand a lot of the things that we do need now for survival. And survival is the name of the game out on the Pribilof, as I mentioned yesterday. And we're going to take the state to task for help, not just the federal government. We have taken the federal government to task, and I think we'll probably go back again for the filling of the basket, because I think the amount of money that was received there for, as was mentioned earlier, support of the islands under the International First Eagle Treaty has been withdrawn to the tune of $6.3 million a year. You know, that's a lot of money. $20 million isn't going to cover all of that, and we know that. So survival being the name of the game, we're going to have to look to the federal government and the state government, which we are citizens of, for assistance, other than trying to help ourselves with what we have left. I'm saying that because we are depending on the sea for livelihood. And we must deal with international scene in this area, Carter. We have to deal with the International Halibut Commission to raise our halibut quotas in order to survive up there, and we have done that. We have to deal with the International Fur Seal Commission for subsistence use of a fur seal, which I don't think we should have to do, but we must, and we're going to have to pay our own way to Moscow this year to approach the international scientists to increase the use of the fur seal, for Pete's sake. Excuse me, St. Peter. I didn't mean to use your name in vain. But, you know, we have to do these things, and it costs money to try to exist on a culture that we're used to. We have to deal with international bodies. In 1982, just to cite an example, incidentally, the foreigners caught 6.2 million pounds of halibut in the Bering Sea alone. And the International Halibut Commission was going to give us, in our new area, 200,000 pounds of halibut to catch in 3 month period. And I said, well, that's not enough. One village alone can catch 800,000 pounds easy, and we can. I said, you're just giving us pittance. And as a result of the argument over the fact that the foreigners had been allowed to take 6.2 million pounds of halibut, and they were only giving us 200,000 pounds, they doubled that to 400,000 pounds. And we went back this year and tried to get that increase, and we only succeeded in getting additional 250,000 pounds. But you know, these are the kinds of things that we must forever be dealing with in order to survive. Survival of a community. And this is for the people who live in the village to survive. And they depend on that. And one of the things, you know, self-sufficiency and self-determination aspects here, the community of St. George, the people themselves there, have stated so many times in so many words that they want to work and support themselves and their families. They do not want welfare. And they make it loud and clear when they go to Juneau to lobby. And, you know, lobbying costs money. And we are fighting for a harbor, as you know, a breakwater that's going to cost in the neighborhood of $19 million. We must finish it from the start. And because it's a one-phase thing, we can't phase it in number one, phase it in number two, like the other island is able to do. So we must have that harbor. We must have a protective harbor to survive from the sea if we're going to do it on a commercial basis. It's very important to us. Then that brings me down to the subject that Mr. Carter raised. And I think we handled very well, I think, to the best of our abilities, the problem of land claims. And it was a land claim. The land was ours. We took care of that pretty well. But we missed one important item: water rights. I think that if nothing else comes out of this meeting, I hope we will address that to some extent and see just what we are talking about. There are 25,000 miles of waterfront in Alaska. Enough to go clear around the world. Look at the amount of water we control. And the 200-mile limit is a law. And there is such a thing as a law of the sea. Who is best fit to interpret that law to us today? I think we need to look at these things. I think we really need to examine what our rights are under the law of the sea and for subsistence use among the water surrounding us, because we very much, for survival, depend on the water in my country that I speak for. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Lekanoff. Mr. Hope, would you like to contribute something at this stage? All right. Well, is that... Well, I guess that this might be a good time then to stop for lunch, and perhaps we could come back at 1:15. Would that be all right? And then Mr. Hope, suitably fortified, will be ready to impart wisdom to us all.
Well done. Good.
think about starting again? Go away for half a day and somebody takes your chair. Well, I think we'll come to order again, ladies and gentlemen, and we'll ask Mr. John Hope to resume the discussion for us now, Mr. Hope.
I knew the participants would be very restive, and my presentation would be presumed to be very, very lengthy when we were all anxious to get out to eat. I think my strategy may backfire. I may put them all to sleep. Jim, it's very difficult to confine yourself in this testimony to Native aspirations as they were perceived back in 1971, and you're living with the act today, and it's very difficult to confine your remarks to that period. You feel impelled to correct those things and comment on things as they are today. I will make an attempt to confine myself to aspirations as I view them and respond to some of the questions. As Mr. Ewan indicated, congratulations are due to the leadership of that time for forging an act and influencing it so that it became less harmful to us. I was remembering that the statute was an instrument of Congress and that they had probably most of the cards in their favor. When you remember the pressures that were prevalent at the time, when you remember that there was a land freeze and that the discovery of oil brought some imperatives, we have to realize that the contributions made by our leaders were very, very worthwhile. And when you look at Congress and how it dealt with Indians in the past, and you put it in that context, you begin to realize that there wasn't that much wiggle room for the Native people in Alaska. When at the very outset, in Section 2B, when Congress said in their Declaration of Policy, the settlement should be accomplished rapidly, with certainty, in conformity with the real economic and social needs of Natives, without litigation, with maximum participation by Natives in decisions affecting their rights and property, without establishing any permanent racially defined institutions, rights, privileges, or obligations, without creating a reservation system or a lengthy wardship or trusteeship, and without adding to the categories of property and institutions enjoying special tax privileges or the legislation establishing special relationships between the United States government and the state of Alaska. So you can see that Congress pretty much said you would form a profit-making corporation. However, as Mr. Borbridge indicated, we can view ANCSA as a beginning. I think within the history of the United States, Congress has dealt with Indian tribes and changed the rules often. There were over 650 treaties, and treaties was the traditional way to settle land claims before the Court of Claims became the instrument used by the United States. There were over 650 treaties. I think without exception, those treaties were abrogated by the United States government. Lands were given to Indian tribes, sometimes in places they didn't want the land, because it was the kind of land that Congress could give away, as they termed it, without public indignation. As you recall, the Sioux people were given the Black Hills as part of their religious domain, and it was given to them by treaty. However, gold was discovered in the Black Hills, and Congress changed its mind about giving that land. It took the land back. The Sioux people sued and were awarded $100 million for that land. Some of the Sioux people said, "We don't want your money, we want our land." But Congress, having plenary power, is presumed to be the final authority. Now, in that declaration of policy, some of the things that Congress said would happen did not happen. The settlement was not accomplished rapidly, with certainty, in conformity with the real economic and social needs of natives. It was not formed without litigation. But those things that are harmful to us usually stay in place. And that is the history of the United States, those things that are harmful to the native peoples of the country are always implemented. Those things that are beneficial, sometimes we have to go into court to prove the language of the act is as we understood it. So it becomes somewhat difficult for us in the present day to look back and find that these were the promises of Congress and they were not fulfilled, but those things that may be harmful to us will in fact be fulfilled. But if we look at the act as a beginning and these hearings as an instrument to get our message across, perhaps we can rectify some of the things that we feel are harmful to us at the present time. Usually in land, where the government says the Indians do have a right to the land, they must be compensated for that land, land is retained by the Indian people or the native people. But there never is a caveat like we have in this instance, where title is only assured for a 20-year period. Usually it's in perpetuity, and perpetuity in the United States means until somebody with more power than you eventually takes it away from you. In Indian country, that has been the case. Usually if your land has any value and you have it in perpetuity, they might build a dam over it, or they might take it and have a race to see who gets to the biggest chunk that he wants first, and they'll open it up generally to the public. That is what perpetuity has meant in the past. It's a harsh thing to say against your government, but history is replete with broken promises. I think we can have expectations, however, that we can look at this instrument which has a beginning, and we can offer correcting as time goes on and proves a need. I think the Native leadership can grapple with this as they approach 1991, and I'm almost moving over now into the last 3 days of this session, and I'm trying to avoid them. So maybe I better get back to commenting on the points that were raised yesterday. Fred Paul mentioned that, this is number three, Fred Paul mentioned that at the time of ANCSA, Alaska Natives were opposed to IRAs as a vehicle for receiving the settlement land and money. He suggested that this was because Alaska Natives didn't want to increase the hold the BIA had over them. I think even if we agree or disagree, I think Congress already had declared in their policy that this would not happen. And I think the word probably was on the street that Congress already had made up its mind that there would be no relationship such as suggested by the IRA. I agree with Mr. Paul that the IRAs are a very good vehicle. And if I had the choice today, that's the vehicle I would have selected over any other known vehicle. I think the IRAs have a great potential. And I think the people that framed the Wheeler-Howard Act did it based on experience of reservations. There are some comments here that there was a hesitancy to go into a reservation system. I think if we were to go to Metlakatla and we were to tell them, would you exchange what we have for what you have, I think they would say, no thank you. A lot of us don't understand reservations, and when we don't understand them, just like human nature, we have a little hesitancy to accept them. So I think I agree with Mr. Paul, and I think between the lines he was saying it's a good vehicle. Number four, have the goals of Alaska Natives changed since 1971? I don't think the goals have changed. I think times do change, and society as a whole, they view things a little bit differently. I think the expectation level of a shareholder, we don't call them natives when we talk about corporations, we talk about shareholders. The expectation levels of the shareholders are very, very high. I think most of us expected to go to Hawaii on an annual basis with the proceeds of a land claims act. I think that's no exaggeration. I think we all expected that our land is worth a lot of money, and because of that, we would have almost could retire and live off the benefits of the act. So that is still very, very high. I think there is probably some of our shareholders becoming disillusioned now. The village people, those people enrolled villages, probably didn't receive more than $100 each. The act tried to protect the older people and mandated that at least 10% of the money distributed to the village corporations would be distributed to the shareholders. And that was a gesture towards the older people among our shareholders. The second half of that question, are the things that were important to them in 1971 still important today? And I think they are. I think land is still a very, very important element of the Land Claims Act. And I think land, as was expressed this morning, if you were to weigh what do you want, land or money, I think land clearly would be the choice of people even today. And the other one, number seven, I'm skipping down, Mr. Frank referred to the idea of substituting perpetual membership for enrollment as a means of including Native children born since 1971. And Mr. Paul rightfully said the IRA as a vehicle would accomplish that because the IRA tribes control their membership. And if the assets of the tribe were to benefit the membership, then the children of the members of a tribe would be also the beneficiaries. I think the other thing that was very apparent at that stage, and remember the pressures were very great because Mr. Udall had imposed a land freeze, and the oil companies really took note of that at that time. But I think there was, as Mr. Paul alluded to, there was a fear from some of the politicians, and some of them are still in office, that proceeds of the land claim settlement might be used politically. And I think they didn't view that political use as being in their favor. I think they were afraid it might be used against them. So there was a provision in the Act that no money received from the distribution of that Act would be used for political purposes. However, those monies have long since drained, and the monies that are now in the corporation are monies that they've been able to earn, and I'm not sure that the constraints of the Act still apply. They may feel, maybe some court might still feel that it applies, because some of the assets owned by the corporations are resulting from the money that were distributed to the corporation. Mr. Chairman, I look forward to contributing in the last 3 days of this, where I think our latitude is dealing with today and improving upon today. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Well, thank you, Mr. Hope. Thank you very much. Would you like to add something, Mrs. Dementiev?
I guess I'll go down the list like Mr. Hope did. Regarding use and occupancy of the land, I did a small study on my own in our village, and I found out that we have almost no more out-migration. More people have come back, so we have more people using and needing the land, and also more need for the resources, especially subsistence resources on our land. At the same time, no one in our area has title to their land. We also were expecting that the cash settlement would be important. In our village, you cannot get a loan to build a home or start a business because you have nothing to put up for collateral. You can't buy fire insurance because you don't own your land. Many things like that. So we really, really aren't seeing any economic development. We don't welcome people coming in to start things in our village. We would like to start them ourselves, but we can't. We don't have the money. Resolution of past social ills and full participation in the future. I think we have more social ills, and I think that's caused from confusion. And it's not just from ANCSA. It's from the pressure that comes from having to be a second-class city, having to be on school boards, many of the things that the other people have mentioned. Having to do that without knowing how has caused more problems and more social ills. We would like to solve our social ills ourselves, but we still keep getting people coming to tell us what our problems are and how to solve them. I think we should at least have the right to say what our problems are and suggest solutions. We've always been self-sufficient and determined. Because people don't really, outside of our, people who don't belong to our area don't understand our culture, they keep saying we're losing it. From my point of view, it's there, it's alive and well, and we plan to keep it that way. But the one thing that I think is going to be very important to understand is in our culture, we identify ourselves by the place we come from. I notice other people, they'll say, I'm so-and-so, I'm the head of this, or I work here, or that. But we say, I'm so-and-so from this place, and my relatives are so-and-so and so-and-so. And when we talk about our land, we're talking about our place, and therefore we're talking about our identity. I totally agree with Don Wright's statement, and this is the way I remember it. I think we had a very bad picture. We didn't understand what reservations were. We were taught about these poor, starving Indians on barren land. We didn't see any successful IRAs, so how could we choose or even talk about such a thing before land claims? At the same time, when we were talking about fighting for our land, we could see our land, we know our land was vast and rich. But we couldn't understand all the millions of words that were said about how the people in the lower 48 lost their land. After the land claim settlement, I flew over the continental United States, and I was so amazed to see it looked like some kind of a jigsaw puzzle. If we had seen a picture like that, it would have been worth many, many more words. We would have understood much more clearly what it is we were trying to avoid, what it was we were trying to hang on to. I don't think our goals have changed at all. And the things that were important in 1971 are still important. One thing that we expected in our village was control over our living resources, our fish and our game. There are people who come even from other countries to hunt in our areas. And I agree with the man who said that he said something about we sacrifice an animal to strengthen ourselves. I think when we talk about subsistence, we're not just talking about feeding our bodies. We're talking about feeding our spirit as well. And if the state, with all their experts, cannot come up with a legal definition of subsistence, maybe they should come to us and we'll try to teach them for a change. Subsistence is such a big thing. It is us. It is our body and soul. The afterborn. You're not talking about my grandchildren when you talk about the afterborn. My children were born native. They weren't made native by an act of Congress. I'm going to be a teacher in a few years, in about a year. And maybe for a few years, my students will be stockholders. After that, they won't be. How will I teach them? What will I say to them? Let me tell you, I will try to make them so sharp that no matter what the law says, they will take it over and they will say, we belong. because right now we're educating them to be proud to be Native. There's so much thing to say, really, but everybody has said a lot, and I think that I'll stop there.
Thank you very much. Lily McGarvey,
I spoke before about the rapid phase of change that ANCSTA put our Native people into. We were forced to take roles that we never dreamt we would ever hold. People in the villages had to run corporations. Some of them never heard of a corporation before, and yet they were running them all of a sudden. And I mentioned the disruption to the family. Thank goodness that we had some educated Natives, some giants that went to Congress and spoke for us and were successful in getting the Alaska Native Claim Settlement Act passed. I hope they know that we appreciate that. The Aleuts, as I say, had a very tragic history. When you talk about land, I think of all the land that we have lost. When the Russians came, all I had to do was mention the Russians. When the Russians came, the Aleuts numbered, they say, between 16 to 40,000 people. In 50 years, that number had dwindled to 2,500. The Aleuts increased and numbered about 6 to 7,000. And then came along World War II, and then the Alaska Native Claim Settlement Act. We are one of the smallest regions, numbering in our enrollment just a little over 3,000 people. I think it's something like 3,030, something like that. So it was to the detriment of the Aleuts to have the Alaska Native Claim Settlement Act passed on the basis of per capita. It would have been better for us if it had been based on land loss. And Flory and others have mentioned our marine subsistence. I agree that part of the land settlement should have included some of the marine areas that we have used traditionally since anyone can remember. The Aleuts have always subsisted from the sea, sea mammals and fish and all of the little goodies from the reefs that surround our shores. When I mentioned allotments this morning, I forgot to mention an incident that happened. I was living in Anchorage, and I had a daughter living out in the island. And I told her about the Allotment Act, that it was going to be no more after the Claims Act passed. So if possible, we should get some land that we had been using. And so she picked out a spot that she thought she would like to claim as an allotment, and I went to BLM with her. At BLM, we were told by Mr. Gustafson that in the land claim settlement site, Flory Lekanoff and Mike Lesenkoff had put in the name of St. George Island into the lands that we were fighting for. And that was all that was recorded at BLM. Thank goodness for guys like that, but wouldn't it have been sad if the Aleuts at the settlement only got St. George Island. So we went to our board and our lawyer, and I made a motion at our next board of directors meeting that we should include all of Aleutian territory in our fight for our land claim. When I spoke about disruption to families this morning, one of the things I didn't mention was our elders. Some of the elders have written to us, called us, and said, we won't be here when everybody really reaps the goodies from the act. Is there anything, any way we can get a loan to fix our house or do this and that right now? Well, it's sad to say that some of those that wrote those letters are already passed on. And they never really gained any economic enhancement from the act, which we all hoped for at the time the act was passed. And it's still that way to this day. Until we all do something to make sure that our elders will benefit while they're still here, no one else is going to do it. We have to do it. And when we think about 1991, that's still a long ways away. Our elders need that betterment today. I don't know how to do it, but I think we ought to think about it and act on it right now, not wait till 1991. Because I think our elders are really the most eligible people for this settlement. They're the ones who gave up so much. And resolution of past social ills and full participation in the future. I worked quite a bit in health. Spent a lot of time on health boards at the local level, state level, and national level. I took a job with Congress on the health task force of the American Indian Policy Review Commission, of which John Borbidge was a member. I went all over the lower 48 and all over Alaska, holding hearings and talking to tribes and individuals about our health status, our needs. I have to mention an incident that happened which kind of demonstrates some of the situations. I did a lot of traveling, was away from home. My poor husband finally learned how to cook. He couldn't boil water before that. But when the statewide Native Health Board invited the National Health Board to Anchorage for a meeting, we had a dinner at the Sheffield House, the Travelodge. And during the dinner, I was sitting at the speaker's table, and my husband, whom I had invited, was sitting farther down at another table. And as during my speech, I mentioned that I wanted to introduce my husband, who made my work possible through his support and understanding. He got up and he said, well, I have to say that it's nice to have dinner with my wife for a change, even though she's across the room. And that situation was prevalent in a lot of Native families. People were separated. I found out that you can be the loneliest person on earth in the midst of a crowd in Washington, D.C. I guess it's simply because you're not sharing it with loved ones. And as I said, some marriages did not survive this new life, new lifestyle. And it didn't only affect two people, two partners. There were the children involved. There was the mother and father of the partners on both sides. There were cousins and aunts and uncles. In an extended family, it affects the whole family. And in a small community, it affects the whole community because families make up a large part of communities, each family. In our health situation, I agree with, I forgot who said it this morning, that if we had spent some of our dollars on alleviating our health problems, our money would have been gone a long time ago. In the early 1950s, there was a study, the Perrin Report, on the health status of Alaska. In that time, they reported there were two Alaskas, Native Alaska and White Alaska. While the white segment's health was on a par with the rest of the nation, the health of the Alaska Natives was probably at the worst level in the nation, if not the world. There are many disparities in the Native health situation, and although Indian Health Service has done a lot to alleviate that, they continue to lack funds. Congress has never appropriated them enough money to do their job. And although the Self-Determination Act has passed and a lot of the responsibilities for health care is now being handled through Native health corporations, that situation has not changed, isn't it? We still don't have enough money, and the health of the Alaska Natives is still way below the rest of the Alaska and the nation.